Hello, this is John Cleese, and you're listening to the Podcast Network.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. And now, here's Rod Adams and the Atomic Show. It's atomic, yeah. It's atomic.
Rod Adams coming to you from Annapolis, Maryland, and it's time for Atomic Show number 70. Today I have with me Ray Haraldson, a man who we talked to for the last two Atomic Shows. He is a man who I refer to as an atomic tinkerer, one of the pioneers of the nuclear power industry and the nuclear technology in general. Ray is an electrical engineer who was hired by Idaho National Laboratory in 1952 and worked on the experimental breeder reactor program and the boiling water reactor series of experiments before moving on to do a lot of other things in the nuclear industry. Over the last couple of weeks, we've talked about his experiences with EBR-1 and the first couple of boiling water reactors, the Borax reactors. And today we're going to talk to Ray about an evolution that he was one of the major contributors to, an evolution where the first city in the United States and perhaps even in the world was lit by electricity that was produced solely in a nuclear heated system. And Ray, I'd like to go ahead and let you get started and tell your story in your way.
Okay, I would begin with reminding you what the background was. The Borax 2, the predecessor, the one that we used to light the town of Arco, had been tested all the way to destruction, and it had already shown that the boiling concept was perhaps viable, that you could actually use the boiling aspect in a viable power plant, that boiling itself was perhaps even a safety factor in case a reactor went into the boiling mode. But the components for Borax 3, the one that lit Arco, was already on hand when that Borax 2 was tested to destruction. And that was a rebuilt version of Borax 3. But Borax 3 was quite a different reactor. That is, instead of being built in a hole in the ground, it was actually had a building over it, and a steam generator plant, and we were able to operate it up to as high as 8 megawatts. We now had a purification plant connected to it, feed water pumps, pressurizer, and pressure control, and we were producing steam. Now, that's the fall of 1954, and that is the moment when the Russians made an announcement that ended up directing us towards doing what we did with regarding lighting of Arco. The International Atomic Energy Agency was already in existence, headquartered in Geneva, Switzerland, and they were holding conferences each year where all nations were invited to participate. Both the United States and the Russians had declined to participate, but were there to hear. They didn't participate because we all had safety limitations on us, and we was presumed to be so far advanced ahead of the rest of the world that it is irrelevant.
Brief editorial comment. The limitation was security considerations, not safety considerations. Now, back to the show.
But the Russians announced that they were going to participate in the following international conference in the July of 1955. And now that's still more than 6 months away, but nevertheless, it attracted attention in the United States because it was obviously going to be a propaganda event where they would announce that they were going to present a paper regarding their 5-megawatt power plant for civilian use. And this left the United States wondering what to do, and they thought, well, they should join the conference and present a paper counterposing or at least equaling whatever the Russians were about to do. And one possibility was the shipping port reactor, which would be coming online about that time. But its heritage was a power plant that looked very much like the power plant on a nuclear submarine. But on the other hand, they could look at Borax, which was now producing 8 megawatts of steam power, and it has no heritage related to a military application. And what would be needed would be to connect a turbo generator to this reactor plant and maybe even supply power to an American city. But not much time to do it. But they decided that maybe we could, and they only had 6 or 7 months to do it. It was initiated with a very high priority, and the contract was let to a cost-plus basis to Morrison Knudsen, who was a power plant specialist company at that time. It's not the same Morrison Knudsen that exists today. But they were the ones who proceeded to find and connect a turbo generator to this reactor. And they found a 3¾-megawatt used and a retired turbo generator in a mill pond near Albuquerque, New Mexico. It was a turbo generator that was actually built in 1925.
Now,
why did we have to go to a turbine that was that old
for this very new power system?
It was necessary to get a turbine that would be capable of running on wet steam, because that's what the Borax reactor put out, and modern turbines are dependent on steam that had been dried with superheaters. And so they had to look for something that was either built special for it, or they had to find some old used machine like this one. And that's what they found, and they brought it up, bought it, and brought it into the situation where we were, and they completed the addition in the spring of 1955. Well, this included the complete power plant, including 2 cooling towers and all of that. And now we were getting close to where we seriously was contemplating getting the system in operation and make our connection to like this little town of Arco. But we didn't only had a couple of months left to do it. And there was 2 problems that showed up that were serious, and with not enough time to correct them. And one of them was that the control rod system did not have enough range to overcome the xenon effect of the reactor. Now, old-time reactor power plant operators are very familiar with xenon. Xenon is a product that tends to poison the operation of the reactor depending on how long you're at power. The reactor itself produces it, and the way to overcome it is to load the reactor a little heavier and a little more range in the control rods. But there was not enough time to redesign the control rods. And so the solution they decided on to do this within the time limit we had was to use chemical control. And I do not know whether anyone else has ever used chemical control or not, but in this case, the chemical control was the matter of adding boric acid water to the coolant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, boron is a strong poison of neutrons and tends to shut reactors down, and that we would put in boric acid into the coolant water,
mm-hmm.
and then overload the reactor such that within the range of the control rods, we could still go to power, but eventually the xenon would start coming into play and the reactor would start to die. That is, the nuclear reaction would start shutting down.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, we would turn on the pure water purification system and take the boric acid out, and we'd be at power and be able to run indefinitely, and that's when we would be lighting ARCO.
Okay.
Turned out that part worked. But with a complication. The second problem had to do with the fact that the turbo generator that they purchased was was designed for 2,300 volts. Now, the Borax facility was on a spur power line from the central facilities area of the nuclear reactor testing station. That is, the central facilities of our complex was 2.5 miles away.
Okay.
And we're on a line that's 2.5 miles long, and it's a different voltage. It's 12,000 volts instead of 2,300 volts. And normally the solution to this problem, we simply get a transformer and make the conversion.
Right.
But we were told there was no such transformer available west of the Mississippi. And so the solution to this problem, which was a dubious idea, was to get the reactor up to power and then supplying its own needs, then disconnect that spur 2.5 miles of power line and reconnect it as a 2,300 volt line. This would have to be done by a Highline crew, and the Highline crew in this case, it was not our own employees. They were not the utilities employees. They were employees of the subcontractor who were managing the NRTS at that time. That's Phillips Petroleum Company. So they were the ones who were going to do this work, and it turned out that they were vital to our operation. But now, in this case, I'll outline the plan, how it was supposed to take place.
Okay. Can I ask you a couple questions before we go
Surely.
On? Do you remember about how high the pressure was in the reactor, in the Borax? What kind of steam pressure were you able to get to?
Well, I can't remember for sure what pressure we were operating at. The pressure vessel was rated at 600 pounds.
Okay, so.
And I think we were probably running about 400.
All right, so we got the plan now that we're still going to try to use some sort of, start up, disconnect, and then re-voltage the line to get going at somewhere around 2,300 volts, you said?
Yes.
Okay, so you go ahead and go on with your story from there. Sorry to interrupt.
I'll describe how it was supposed to be done and tell you what really happened, because the first try was a total failure. We take the reactor to power with the benefit of the boric acid, and as the xenon effect came into play, we'd remove the boric acid with the ion exchange columns, start up the turbo generator, synchronize it to the system, and then we de-energize the transmission line between our reactor and the central facilities area. Then they'd reconnect the line to the Borax at 2,300 volts, and now it would require resyncing, that is, resynchronizing our system with the utility system. Now, that connection would be closed at central facilities, not at the reactor. And it would have to be done by the central facilities utility substation operator, who was an employee of the utility. He was brought in temporarily with a temporary substation on wheels that was used for the purpose. Then when he succeeded in making that connection, then he disconnected all other power sources to ARCO, so there would be clearly a fact that all of the power going to ARCO would be from this reactor. Then after the success of this operation, then of course you do everything in reverse to get left to let go of it. Well, here's what actually really happened. The reactor was taken to power, and later the boric acid was removed. But we had an emergency diesel generator nearby to help us out in case we had some problem. But of all times for a diesel generator to fail, that's exactly when it did fail. Now, the decision, well, what do we do now? Well, we didn't think we would really need it. With a little luck, we wouldn't need emergency power. So we went ahead without the benefit of emergency power. And the Borax generator was successfully synchronized with the transmission line through a low-voltage portion of our network at 480 volts. It's a very weak connection. And I could tell when we made that connection that it was a little bit on the nervous side, because I could hear the turbine generator just oscillating just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And the Highline crew came into play, and they disconnected the transmission line between ourselves and central facilities without any problem. And then they reestablished the line at 2300 volts. Now, note that this 2300 volts is one-fifth of its normal voltage. And if you know electrical Ohm's law, when you drop a voltage by a factor of two, you square it to get the losses anyway. So the line losses was going to be not five times as low, but 25 times higher than it would be in the normal operation. And that's what really got the operation in trouble. It turned out that they are successful in making the reconnection at the central facilities, and then we were floating on the line with the rest of the utility grid at that point, but not supplying any particular power. However, the substation operator said that it looked to him like we had low voltage, and so we upped the voltage on our generator to its maximum, which was 2,700 volts.
Okay.
And then he was at the point that he would disconnect all other connections to ARCO. And as he proceeded to do so, we were in deep trouble quickly. He reported that the voltage dropped to 70% of normal on his end. And really what was happening very quickly was that we were overdriving our little 2.5 mile line.
Mm-hmm.
And some weak point gave up, and the actual line actually failed, actually broke, and came to the ground.
Wow.
And
but that's kind of dramatic.
Now we were, and the substation operator opened up all his breakers, and we were without power. And our reactor reacted by shutting down according to the way it's designed to do.
Right.
And now we're in the dark. Reactor is shut down, but it's shut down by virtue of the xenon effect. Now, if you contemplate what that really means, normally xenon is a thing that is a pretty pain to most reactors, but in this case, our reactor is held down by the benefit of the xenon.
Okay.
But the xenon is only there temporarily. It has a half-life, about 9 hours, I think?
Yeah, well, something like that. When xenon, when you first shut down the reactor, xenon builds up for a while, and in about 9 hours it hits a peak.
Right.
And then it starts decaying away.
Yeah, it peaks up and then dissipates. Well, I'm not sure how many hours we had, but they were limited. And if they didn't get the power line back into operation, we had no way to pump boric acid back into the reactor to keep it shut down.
Okay.
So that was a very nervous thing we found ourselves in.
Hi, it's Rod again with an aside. Just to give a little more clarity on the situation that the reactor found itself in, is that, remember, this reactor was a hastily designed effort, and the determination had been that the number of control rods in the reactor was not enough to give a full range of operation from zero xenon to full xenon and back down to zero again. So as Ray had described, there was an alternative method of reactivity control using boric acid. But the situation that Ray and his friends found themselves in was that the reactor had been operating at power for a while. All of the boron had been removed. Xenon was in the core. The control rods were out. When the power was lost, the control rods went in, but there was still no boron in the core, and there was xenon keeping the core in a subcritical condition. The effect that xenon has after shutdown, though, is it builds up for about 10 hours and then gradually decays away as iodine, its precursor, has been decaying away, and the xenon decays away with its own natural 9.2-hour half-life. At about the 35-hour point, the xenon concentration after a full power trip is back down to it was when it's at full power. And from then on, the reactivity in the core becomes greater and greater as the xenon continues to decay away to zero.
So at about the 45 or 50 hour point, there's essentially no xenon left in the core because its five half-lives are gone. The thought here at the Borax reactor was that at that point the reactor may become critical on its own and be able to sustain a chain reaction. And since there was no instrumentation energized, there was some nervousness about what would happen to the core. There's also no ability to pump water back in the core, so if there was a sustained period of this critical operation, the water may boil away and eventually cause some overheating. But there was quite a bit of time available, although being there with no power and a down power line and a broken diesel generator could cause some nervousness.
But as it turned out, the Highline crew were under unmerciful pressure by our people to get that power line back up, and I don't think we ever explained to them why it was so important. I don't think they know to this day why it was so important to get that power line back up again.
Was there anybody yelling at them?
Yes, our leader, Dr. Walter Zinn, was putting in unmerciful pressure on them to get that line up, and they did work all through the night, and they brought in people for to help them, and they did it. They got it back up, and so the crisis went away.
Okay.
But an interesting thing happened. The substation, temporary substation operator over at Central Facilities, with nothing to do when there was no, while they were working on the power line, he was wandering through a storage area there at Central Facilities and found the transformer we didn't think existed.
And what was that? What was the ratings for that transformer?
It was converted. It was plenty of capacity. I don't remember its capacity, but they were sizable transformers, and they had among the options on it, on the nameplate, that we could convert 2,300 volts to 12,000. Exactly the transformer we needed.
Yeah, that's convenient.
Those transformers were loaded aboard flatbed trucks almost immediately and driven over to Borax, and we wired them in place without even taking them off the trailer. They're wired right in.
Okay, now this was a transformer that was left over from the old Naval Proving Grounds or something?
I don't know the heritage of those transformers.
Okay.
But they were there, and and conveniently so.
There and not in use, so they were ready for a move, I guess.
Right, they were in the storage area behind a storage fence and with a lot of other equipment, but the substation operator spotted it and looked at it and said, this is what they need, and it surely was true. So it wasn't long until we were back in position where we were able to light ARCO without the problem of the mismatch between a 2,300-volt system and the 12,000-volt system. And proceeded to repeat our operation this time, though the sequence is a little different. You leave out all that time when we're floating on the line and where the synchronization is going on at Central Facilities. This time we had to do the synchronization right there at our plant, and I was the one who did that. And it came off very easily. The only problem was that we didn't have the luxury of a synchroscope. And
so what were you using instead?
We were just using a little old voltmeter. And now the synchroscope makes it so that ordinary folks can close exactly the right moment. With a voltmeter, you got to be a little more on the ball, and in this case, you got to watch for the null points. And when you get the velocity of the turbine right and the voltage right, you can close that without any problem. And that happened very well, very good and very even. And then the substation operator over at Central Facilities only has to disconnect the outcoming lines from leaving us connected to ARCO. And at that point, we're supplying power to ARCO uniquely from a boiling water reactor and making the history that's relived to this day.
How far away was ARCO?
Pardon?
How far away was ARCO from your facility?
It's about 20 miles away, and population is a few thousand. Now we would have supplied power to them earlier that afternoon, except that there was another incident occurred where one of the Highline crew members made a mistake and took us down a second time. One of the things he has to check is to make sure that our rotation of our turbine is the same as the system.
Mm-hmm.
And on the previous day, he did this by snapping a device for checking it onto the terminals of a 480-volt breaker.
Okay.
Now, that's not unthinkable to connect by hand connections to 480 volts. But now this is a different day, and this is not 480 volts, it's 2300 volts. And when he snapped his connections on there, his meter blew up in his face and peppered his hands with molten particles from the vaporized wires that were connected to it.
Mm-hmm.
And that also caused the reactor to shut down. And it lost us a few hours. It took several hours to recover, but it made it that such that we were actually connecting to ARCO in the evening rather than in the mid-afternoon.
Okay.
And but we were supplying power to ARCO about 10 o'clock in the evening, and the load was very minimal. It wasn't very many of a burden for our turbogenerator. I don't think their load was more than a half a megawatt.
Uh-huh.
But that's not the end of the story either. When we run it for a couple of hours, we didn't know how long we should do it to make history, but we did for a couple of hours. Now it's about midnight when they decided we're going to reverse this process and resynchronize our system with the area utility. Now that synchronization has to take place at central facilities, and that substation operator had to do it without the benefit of any controls. All he had was the switch and his synchroscope.
Okay.
And he's instructing me by radio telephone how to adjust speed and voltage to make the match.
Okay.
And with a radio telephone, this particular kind we had then, simplex system, it means that you can only one guy talk at a time, and he's got his talk button down, I can't talk to him.
Right.
And he was telling me that it wasn't quite what he wanted, but he was going to act on it. I wished he could have let me explain to him, just hold on, we can do better.
That's right.
But anyway, he closed. Some people said he closed out of sync, but he didn't. He just closed when the systems were rotating a little bit different from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I liken this to when you talk one car with another with a rope or a chain is too weak.
Right.
Yet if you don't start really gentle and get do things in the right order, it can go into oscillation and snap the connection.
Right.
So here we are overpowering our line again. Now, even though it's at 12,000 volts,
mm-hmm.
I could hear our turbo generator oscillating too fast, too slow, too fast. Our lights going up and down and the brightness, realizing that it's actually unstable, and that if it doesn't quiet down, we're in trouble, and we were.
Mm-hmm.
I was about to close disconnect from their system when that power line failed again. So while we were letting go of our connection to ARCO, we lost power and our reactor was shut down again. But now this time we don't have any problem with xenon,
mm-hmm.
because we got a boric acid dump on there, put on there in a matter of a few hours.
Mm-hmm.
So we could put water in there, boric acid in there, whether it was a feed water pumps or not. So there was no real problem there.
So this was a new system that you guys had added since the last time?
It was a very simple system. It was just a standpipe on top of the reactor with a valve on top and on bottom. You poured the boric acid in, opened the top valve, poured the boric acid in, and let it sit there. And if you ever need it, open the bottom valve.
Okay.
It falls in. All boiling water reactors have boric acid dumps on them now. But that's not the end of the story either.
Oh, okay.
At that time, there was Argonne National Laboratory was the host of what was called the International School of Reactor Technology. And it was sponsored by the State Department with students from mostly from third world countries, mm-hmm. with the idea that nuclear power was the wave of the future and a way to lift third world countries out of their poverty and having enough energy to do bigger things with it. Anyway, the International School of Technology had about 60-some students, and they were destined to come and visit our site the day after we lit ARCO. But with the power line down, maybe our plant would be not in operation. It would be much nicer if it was in operation for put on a little show for them as well. Not only that, well, the Russians now knew that we were going to present a paper on a boiling water reactor and the lighting of an American town.
Mm-hmm.
And they were challenging whether there ever was such a thing as a boiling water reactor.
Okay.
When that International School of Technology students arrived at our site, our reactor was back up and operating just like nothing had ever happened. Even though the transformers are still on that flatbed truck there right beside the reactor,
mm-hmm.
but we were there just like as if it was a typical ordinary day, and it was the students from the international school that notified the International Atomic Energy Agency, yes, indeed, the Americans do have a boiling water reactor. We know it because we were there, and it was operational when we were there.
Okay. Now, let me ask you a couple more questions. As I understand the timing of this, EBR-1, that experimental breeder reactor that you talked about in a previous show, was generating a certain amount of electricity for its own use.
It had a 250-kilowatt turbo generator on it, but not sufficient to really supply power beyond our own needs.
Right.
So okay. We could synchronize with the outside line and did,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps send a little bit of power, but we could not hope to really send power over to ARCO with the power with the system we had. It took more power than that.
Right.
And but we had been in operation long enough that it was a very simple thing to crank up that turbine and run it, and that's where we got the experience. It's how we knew how to run this 3¾ megawatt turbine. Our experience was on that 250 kilowatt. It was a little different animal because our turbine on EBR-1 was designed for superheat, and we didn't have the same problems with it.
Mm-hmm.
And we even had a synchroscope with that reactor, so we were familiar with making casual connections, and we did it quite regularly. In this case, the substation operator on by radio telephone said, "I'm going to catch it the next time around." And our rotational velocity of our turbine was a little different than the system.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a strong enough line connecting your system to theirs where it can exchange power back and forth quickly.
Right.
If our machine is a little too fast, it'll load it so heavy it'll back down.
Right.
And vice versa. Even if it's a little on the slow side, then we'll take power from outside to speed it up. But when you get in this situation with a very weak line, it just cannot exchange that energy fast enough and large enough. And that with this weak line was our big problem.
Mm-hmm.
So we were very familiar with using a synchroscope, and the traditional scheme was close just a little ahead of dead center.
Right.
Preferably with a little bit of positive RPM on your system versus whoever you're connecting with.
Right.
And that seemed like it just worked very well. It would just lock right on, and there would be no sound coming from the generator that wasn't familiar, and things mm-hmm. would work very well.
And as I recall, it's been a long time since I did a parallel operation, but the way that you pick up load with the new generator is to, once you close that breaker, you raise the speed of your generator just a tiny little bit more, and all of a sudden it's got all the load, and you can disconnect the other generator without any real problem.
Yes, you would normally think if you just change the voltage, you'd load your system up, but with a governor in action and a functional, good governor on your turbo generator,
mm-hmm.
What you really need to do is just simply increase the steam to the generator, and it'll automatically pick up that power.
Right.
And even if the voltage is a little out of match, it will still adjust for that. And by what they call reactive power,
Right.
You want it nearly the same or as close to the same as you can, but it's tolerant and forgiving. Mm-hmm. Even if the voltage is not quite the same.
As I remember, if you make the volt, if you try to pick up load by increasing the voltage, that causes a reactive power circulation rather than a real power picking up.
That's right.
Yeah, that's
kind of a complex picture and technically
right.
complicated, but yes, that's the way it is.
Yeah. Now let's go back and talk a little bit more about this boiling water reactor. The initial boiling water reactors, the 1 and 2, you said were kind of in an open tank, and they had initially a lid that you thought, that the original designers thought could be closed to get some pressure in there, but that didn't work so well. But this third one, you had a regular pressure vessel, right?
Yes.
Okay.
For Zorks 1 and 2, it was supposed to be a pressure vessel, but it was only rated for 150 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually a flange series of sections.
Okay.
And they were not really that leak tight, and they only tried to pressurize it once, and it just leaked too badly. It was not going to do it, and the pressure was not good enough anyway. So
mm-hmm.
we needed a real pressure vessel.
Right.
And that first one, as I mentioned, you go out in the desert, dig a hole in the ground, put a shield tank down, put a reactor tank inside the shield tank, put the reactor inside that, and that's Borax 1 and 2.
Okay. Now, of course, generating power by using steam was pretty well proven technology. And, you know, one of the things that's always comments that I hear from the people who don't like nuclear power very much that always irritates me is, well, nuclear is just an expensive way to create steam. And that comment just bothers me because creating steam is the way we produce electricity for the vast majority of our power. And, it, you know, we've always been, you know, working hard to create better steam. But creating steam is very important. And a way to create steam without burning something, you know, I think is a pretty fascinating piece of technology.
Yes, and from what I said, you know, having been retired for 14 years, looking back, I note also that while there were several power plants that got in trouble, that is, reactors, and there were several meltdowns, that there had been none for many years. And I wonder if it isn't a little bit like steam power plants on in general, and particularly for naval propulsion, back about Abraham Lincoln's time, where there were a lot of steamships running up and down the Mississippi with paddle wheelers, and many of them had accidents, and they were bad, and they took lives with them.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a learning curve involved, and I wonder if that isn't what we've just gone through with nuclear power, since there have been only fatalities we had in the United States was SL1,
mm-hmm.
and that's way back there in time now. But all of the meltdowns that occurred are well understood and have got fixes for them so they can never happen again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, let's see, EBR1, which was an accident, Three Mile Island, the Fermi plant had a failure, but that was caused by a safety baffle on the bottom of the reactor that broke loose and slapped itself on the inlet to the reactor itself,
mm-hmm.
the SL-1, and that's the meltdown history of the United States. Overseas, you got Chernobyl and Windscale, but they're different reactors than we have never ever had here.
Right. Yeah, there's definitely, I study technology and technology history. It's to me one of the most fascinating ways to understand human endeavors. And there's always a learning curve for any technology. And there are even a learning curve as you refine technology and you move from one generation to another. You always learn some new things. And occasionally, you actually relearn things that other folks had learned, but you just didn't find their documentation.
I think that's true.
that's one of the reasons why I've been very interested in talking to you about some of the early learning experiences and how you guys came about that, and to also remind some of my colleagues in the nuclear industry, nuclear business, just how much history and rich discovery and development there was at that National Reactor Testing Station. As I understand it, more than 50 reactors were tested out there, and a lot of that documentation still exists. It is not completely at our fingertips on the internet, but there's plenty of libraries of data and some stuff that has been published for us so that we can go back and learn what's happened before and try to make sure that if we're going to make a mistake, we make a new mistake.
Yes, and I think the technical reporting was pretty good. What I've told you here is more of the human aspects of doing it.
Right.
And also thinking back over it, you know, we had arrived at the point when nuclear power became unpopular. We had some really significant breakthroughs.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that happened at Three Mile Island is because of loss of coolant flow through the reactor. We make reactors now that you can shut off the coolant flow and they will take care of themselves. And then in addition to that, on the
operation,
there's a new breakthrough on the nuclear waste, too. We can make reactors that will burn up the worst of its own waste. And so those two things are significant, and they're pretty well documented and know how to do it.
Oh, yeah. Well, as I'm kind of a broken record. I tell people that a lot of what has happened in the nuclear industry is difficult to understand unless you understand that nuclear power was an interloper in the established energy industry. It was coming in with completely new ideas and new constraints. Instead of having to move vast quantities of material like coal, oil, and gas from place to place, there's not much movement going on, but there's an awful lot of human knowledge that has to be invested in making a reactor that can work and work safely and work reliably. But you don't have to, you know, spend a lot of time building railroads and pipelines and tankers to get the actual fuel from place to place. On my submarine, we were able to load it with one load of fuel that lasted for 15 years. And that load of fuel weighed about as much as I do. Those folks that like to move large quantities of material from place to place or happen to own the rights to large quantities of material don't necessarily like it when they recognize that a guy with a backpack can carry as much energy as their super tankers can.
Yes, and I think most of my coworkers and myself kind of marvel at how people became so fearful of nuclear power. While it has things you got to pay attention to with technology and all, but still the reactors are more forgiving than it'll have you believe, and they even their more serious problems are understood, and there's answers to every one of those questions.
Well, as we discussed last week when you were talking about the EBR-1 meltdown, one of the things that was a big disadvantage for people was the fact that we did operate with a lot of security. Most of the places where reactors were built and operated or tested were in fairly remote parts of the country, and some of them were operated with some very strict security guidelines. So it's not hard to understand that the general population didn't learn much about the technology, even though there are people like you that became very involved and specialized and understood exactly what was going on. It was hard to explain that. It sounds like it in the 1950s or even the 1940s when you were in high school, there was more general understanding of what nuclear radiation does and what fission was and all those kinds of things. I think if I look in my children's high school textbook, you find very little information about those kinds of basic physical phenomena.
Yes, that's true, but I had a chemistry professor back in high school who explained to us, now this is before the atomic bomb, what an atomic bomb would be. And I'm surprised that he was that knowledgeable. He explained how the nuclear reaction would take place and marveled it. And so when I heard about the atomic bomb, I knew exactly what it was. And most people didn't know what it was.
Wow, you must have had a special high school teacher at that time.
I think we did. I do believe we did.
Do you remember his name?
No, can't remember his name.
You know, it's interesting because I've gone back, and one of the interesting tools available on the web is the archive of Time Magazine. And I've gone back and done searches and found that during the period from about 1934 to 1941 or so, there was a lot of articles about atomic energy and atomic fission and the potential of atomic fission. And then you don't see a single word in Time Magazine until about 1945 about that technology. So, you know, once the Manhattan Project started, the wall of secrecy came down pretty hard.
And, you know, our reputation as the reputation of nuclear power, we were always described as positive up until, even including the destruction of Borix. It was written up in Time Magazine as a very positive thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But it was with the meltdown of EBR-1 that, to us at least, that the tone changed from general support to dismay and questioning the whole idea.
Right. And the timing it was bad because that was just about the time that people started becoming aware of the testing programs that were going on the weapons side. Because that was why your leaders decided not to do any announcement or not to do any investigations to what happened, was because there was tests going on the other side of the world.
Yes.
And as people became aware of those tests and the atomic bomb tests and the open atmosphere tests, they started to get very nervous about those kinds of things. And so when they found out that you guys had a problem and you hadn't told them about it, that caused some real concern, I guess. So, you know, it's just a kind of a almost natural, hey, these guys are involved in nuclear testing. Of course, you guys are testing reactors. They associated that with testing weapons, and it was hard to divorce the two.
And regarding our reputation, we didn't object when they over-eulogized us. It was all right. We could handle that. But when they started calling us incompetents and cowboys, we began to wonder, feeling like maybe we were being abused.
Yeah, and I would imagine, and I know that for a fact, that an awful lot of nuclear technologists and people who really understood what's going on became less and less interested in talking to the press and in trying to share their knowledge, the more the antis were successful in criticizing the nuclear technologists, the more the nuclear technologists simply kind of withdrew and didn't bother talking to the press. It's disheartening because, you know, it's not good to be someone who spends, you know, a good long time in school and works really hard at something like nuclear physics or electrical engineering, and then have somebody try to paint you as somebody who doesn't know what they're doing.
That partly applies to even myself. I wrote a sizable description of what happened to Borix over 10 years ago, but I purposely did not release it to anyone who might have a news media connection because I didn't know if they would handle it with honor. And I've decided that things have changed enough now that the truth can be described in detail, in depth, and that it ought to be acceptable.
Well, this is something that I've kind of been on a soapbox for a while with what's called the new media. And there's a lot of folks now who are writing blogs and websites and doing things like we're doing today with podcasting. And the idea for most of these people is that we really believe we have knowledge that we want to share. I'm not a journalism major. It's not my desire or my training to try to write things that get people reading or maybe sell newspapers. I don't necessarily have to tell a balanced story. What I'm interested in doing is trying to tell the truth about something I really think I understand pretty well. I mean, I went through a lot of school to learn this stuff. Maybe my journalism techniques are not quite as polished as some, but I think that the time is right to start being more of a writer and a talker than simply having people pay attention to journalism majors. Because I don't know about you, but you know, I went to school with some folks that are very good at what's called a quick learn, but that means that they know a lot of things very shallow. And don't get into the real depth of understanding that people who become specialists in certain technical fields do.
It's very satisfying to me to see that a little bit of reality seems to be coming back into the picture. When when I retired, I think all my coworkers were the same frame of mind that, well, we're not popular anymore. But eventually they're going to have to rediscover what it was that we did and to make application of it. And I think that's happening.
Well, speaking of application, there have been three announcements of new applications for new nuclear power plants in the last 2 weeks. Constellation Energy has announced that they've applied for a license to build a new power plant near my house in at Calvert Cliffs, Maryland. NRG is a non-utility company that's going to be building two new reactors at the South Texas project, and then Tennessee Valley Authority has also decided that they're going to apply for a new license at Bellefonte, which is a site where they started back in the 70s to build two reactors and got partially completed, then finally gave up when they basically ran out of money. So,
it's very pleasing to me to hear that kind of news.
Yeah, it's coming back, and hopefully, well, all I can say is it's almost, it's not too late yet, but it's getting darn close because there's other sources of energy are showing their limitations. Let's put it that way. So, anyway, Ray, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and knowledge and history over the last several weeks. I really appreciate your time, and I know I've had a lot of good comments from listeners, some officially on the blog and some via email to me personally, because they are the kind of folks that lurk and don't necessarily want to publish their stuff yet. But we're going to get more of those folks on and keep talking about this stuff and trying to share the knowledge and excitement. And if nothing else, I want some kids who are in high school today to realize that there really is a future in atomic energy, and it's a future that can bring a lot of bright lights to the world, not just the little town of Arco, Idaho.
Well, it's been a very pleasure for me to relive the past as well.
All right. Take care, Ray.
Okay.
Hi, everybody. This is Wayne Trammell asking you to join me for the working week. Not the whole week, because neither of us has that much time, but for the Working Week podcast. That's the weekly digest of research, news, and opinion from the pages of managementissues.com. And that's the world's leading site for business, management, and human resources. My guests and I will talk about the news that matters to those of us just trying to survive the working week. That's workingweek.thepodcastnetwork.com.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. Ooh, there's no need to fear. We got
gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.